My name is Vicki Morrell Buchanan. I'm here on behalf of James Collins. I'll reserve a couple of minutes. Once again, this case is a case in which the trial of Mr. Collins was fundamentally unfair and therefore denied him due process of law. To demonstrate the fundamental unfairness of this case, you need to look, first of all, at the Rankin case, the Rankin murder. In that particular case, if you read the Court of Appeals opinion, and if you read the California Court of Appeal opinion, or if you read the opinion of the district court, read the facts as they refer to the Rankin murder. And all the facts are based on layer after layer after layer of unchallengeable hearsay in that case. Everything. Every piece of evidence is based on hearsay.
Now, let me ask you the same question I asked the people in the case before. Let's assume that it all is hearsay. Is it testimony?
It depends on which layer you go to. As to the original statement of Hamilton, no. That is not testimonial.
But well, Hamilton's statement is not testimonial hearsay. What's the constitutional violation then?
The constitutional violation is due process, as was mentioned in both on all of the confrontational cases. Most of them have a due process hook as well. They all mention due process as well.
Well, they mention due process because the Sixth Amendment is applicable to the states through the due process clause. But my question is the same one I asked before. After Crawford, once we determine that a hearsay statement is non-testimonial, doesn't that end the federal confrontation clause analysis?
Not necessarily. But for instance, there is, first of all, there's Chambers versus Mississippi. Also, if you look at Bruton refers in the footnote to Poynter, which is Poynter versus Texas, which is a case that says that failure to allow cross-examination is a violation of the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. It doesn't talk about confrontation. If you look through all of the cases, and you've gone through all of the confrontation cases, there is a statement saying that even we prefer, some of the justices of the Supreme Court prefer to go with the due process analysis. And in reading through these cases, to me that seems to make a lot of sense, especially when you get into a case like this where there's such fundamental unfairness in this case. We're not just talking about the original statement made by Hamilton. The way this Hamilton statement got into the case was not through some direct testimony. Wince and Wells didn't get up on the stand and say, oh, yes, Mr. Hamilton came back after the shooting and said, I shot Miss Rankin, and Mr. Collins told me to. No. The only way the evidence came in was because Mr. Wilkes and Mr. Wells got on the stand and said, I don't remember that, and he didn't say that, and I'm recanting my testimony.
Ms. Buchanan, I got a little bit different take on this. Maybe you could help me. As I understand it, in your opening brief, you concede that Hamilton's statements to Well, Wince, Henson, and Jordan were not testimonial, but argued that the admission of the statements violated the Confrontation Clause. That was in your opening brief.
Correct.
Then the government came back and said, that doesn't violate the Confrontation Clause. Then in your reply brief, you say, Collins concedes that the admission of Hamilton's statements did not violate the Confrontation Clause. Then after you do that, then you argue that the admission violated his right to due process. Now, since that wasn't raised in the opening brief, and since it's only in the reply brief, why haven't you waived that argument?
Because I believe that in the factors and the law that I applied, the Bruton case, the Douglas case, those are all...
Just a minute. You've really got to focus again. I'm being very straight with you. I'm not trying to trick you. I read your briefs. Right at first, I said, "Well, this is a confrontation clause." Then I went to the government's brief, and they said it can't be a confrontation clause for the same old reasons that we got in the last case, and which we get all the time. Then you come back and say, "Well, I agree. It's not a confrontation clause problem." But it is a due process problem, which I read your first brief again. There's nothing in there about due process. The government hasn't had any chance to get after it. You didn't waive it, or you didn't raise it, so I guess I'm saying to myself, I don't know why I'm even talking about this in this case. Seems to me there's only one issue, severance.
Well, if that is in fact true, and if, and reading through the cases that the government did cite, it appeared that the circuit has held that their confrontation clause does not apply to non-testimonial hearing testimony.
That's what the Supreme Court tells us.
I mean, we're not going off on our own on that.
On Morton.
I'll be fair about that.
So I didn't understand
that. He would have been drug into that closely.
I did not understand that, the previous argument, because I do think that the Confrontation Clause probably does not apply. Although it was not raised in the opening brief, I think the Court does still have, even though it was raised for the first time as a specific due process claim on reply, I do think there is discretion for the Court to allow the argument.
What's your best case for that?
I don't have a best case, just other than the fact that the cases that say that you raise it up for the first time, it may be waived. It may not be available. So it doesn't say
Did you raise this? I'm sorry. Finish.
Oh, I don't have a specific case, and I did look for a specific case, but I also know that I have had personal experience in cases in which I've been involved where the Court has allowed an argument raised in the reply brief to go forward. So that's all I'm basing it on.
I'm looking at the California court decision, and it's not clear to me because you may have raised it and they may not have treated it, but it appears to me the California court decision turns on the confrontation clause and on state hearsay rules, not on due process. Is that a fair characterization of the California court decision?
I thought you raised it in the habeas proceeding.
Mr. Collins raised it in the habeas petition.
Because the state doesn't argue a failure to exhaust a due process.
Right. And they did raise it. He raised it specifically saying the hearsay evidence problem is both a due process problem and a confrontation problem.
Right. The problem is you didn't raise the due process argument in your opening brief, as Judge Smith has pointed out. And
yes,
it doesn't show up in your arguments until the reply brief.
Right. I followed the I'd love to go back and start all over again, but I did just brief the issue as raised, as put in the Certificate of Appealability, which was based on the Confrontation Clause issue.
Could you turn to the severance argument in this case? Right. Tell me what has the Supreme Court ever said that improper joinder of charges is a violation of the Constitution?
In Bean versus Calderon, which is a case from the circuit, it's not a Supreme Court case, it refers to that as a possible violation in Featherstone and in Harrington versus Meacham, so that there is that it can be a possibility of a that severance can be a due process violation, the failure to sever. Unfortunately, most of the cases that involve the severance issue are based on procedural law and federal procedural law, but there is a reference to the fact that it can, if it actually enters the state trial unfair, that it can rise to the level of being a due process violation.
Didn't we recently say that the Lane case, which has that footnote that suggests that maybe there's a due process right here, isn't firmly established Supreme Court law, and so that an improper joinder, if you will, can't serve as a basis for a habeas claim?
Certainly the statement in Lane probably couldn't, because it was dicta. It was not the actual holding of the case. But I think that being at least elaborates that it can still be a fundamental due process violation if there is not appropriate severance.
So tell me why, under a due process standard, combining the charges in this case was a due process violation.
Well, it was all part of the same fundamentally unfair trial in this case, that all the evidence against Mr. Collins on the Rankin murder was hearsay. And certainly the Jordan testimony was hearsay. Everything was hearsay in this case, in the Hamilton. So what happens when you join in the issue of the Bowman case, which was totally unrelated? There is nothing here. The government claims that there's some sort of gang connection, but there really was no gang connection. At least in Bowman, at least there was a live witness who actually testified to the substance of the case in Bowman. And therefore, in Bowman, that case added credibility to the unsubstantiated case of the Rankin murder. So therefore, the jury could say, boy, you know, there was actually evidence that he shot Bowman, so there's probably evidence that's probably sufficient to say that he shot Rankin as well. Also, because...
What do we do with the California Supreme Court, California court's finding that, Court of Appeals finding that there was no prejudice from the joinder? By what standard do we review that finding?
Under the same standard that we do, and all of a sudden the case escapes me, the standard of substantial injury.
Are we talking Brecht?
No, it
would be under the Brecht analysis. But the federal cases are instructive on the prejudice standard, in which they say, you know, if you're not allowed, you know, if you were required to testify, and they give kind of the standard about what kind of things can lead to prejudice. And one of those things was, for instance, he had an alibi in Bachman, but he didn't have one in the Rankin case. So for the jury to hear him have an alibi in Bowman case, they are saying, huh, why didn't he have an alibi, similar alibi in Rankin? Why didn't he say he was off at Walmart shopping at the time of the murder, of the Rankin murder? So that creates an issue for the jury to look at the two cases and go, wow, he's got an alibi here, but he doesn't have an alibi there. It also had some evidence in Bowman, not good evidence, but there at least was some evidence in Bowman. And also, it's just the whole about propensity evidence kind of issue, which is, this guy's a bad guy. He might have shot Bowman. He deals drugs up in Idaho. Oregon. He deals drugs up in Oregon. He's a bad guy. And if he didn't shoot Miss Rankin, well, you know, he probably did something bad that we're going to get him on. So the whole severance issue, not to mention being joined with Hamilton. He's now in the same case with Hamilton. They've got separate juries, but they're all hearing the same sort of stuff. So it does.
I'm sympathetic to your argument in this sense. If I were on the California court, I might well have found this to be improper joinder. But don't you have to demonstrate to us that no reasonable jurist could have reached the conclusion reached under the AEDPA standard?
I'm not sure.
In other words, they made a determination of no prejudice. And don't we have to determine that that's an unreasonable determination of either law or fact under AEDPA, which is to say, it is a terrible standard. The Supreme Court's articulated it this way, though, that no reasonable jurist could have reached that conclusion?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about the Edwards standard. Under the Brecht standard, it seemed to me that...
No, I meant the standard. This is a habeas case.
I don't recall that they mentioned the Edwards standards. They didn't. They just simply said that there was no prejudice, that there was plenty of evidence. But I don't recall the
Edwards
standard.
I'm sorry. I didn't speak clearly. I meant AEDPA.
The Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act.
Oh, yeah, AEDPA standard. Unfortunately, because of the rank and the hearsay issue and stuff, I think that no reasonable jury should have reached the decision.
Jurist
should have reached the decision they did in this case. I don't think there's any proof at all that Mr. Collins was involved in the Rankin murder.
Would you like to save the balance of your time for rebuttal? You got about a minute and 15 seconds.
Thank you.
Good morning, Deputy Attorney General Jaime Fuster for respondent. I guess I will start talking about the severance issue, since that's where we left at. And I think the key issue here is whether it was unreasonable for the state court to find that there was no due process violation as a result of trying the two charges together. That's what it comes down to. And under that test, then can the court say that no fair-minded or reasonable jurist will ever find this denial to be unreasonable.
Counsel, can I ask you, was the jury instructed in this case that it couldn't use the evidence from one crime to prove the other one?
They were instructed to just decide every count separately. That's what the specific instruction was.
They were not instructed that the evidence on one count was not admissible on the other counts, correct?
No, that wasn't given. What happened in this case?
And, And also, the judge never made a determination of cross-admissibility, did he?
No. I think there was an argument made by the prosecution, both at trial and then on state appeal, that the evidence was partially cross-admissible as to the gang motive for both crimes. So there was some cross-admissibility that went both to the motive for the shootings and to the gang enhancement allegation.
Right, but the state court never determined cross-admissibility.
Well, the state court didn't make a specific ruling, but in denying a related claim concerning whether there was sufficient evidence that the Rankin murder was also gang-related, the state court of appeals said that there was sufficient evidence.
I understand, but just to answer my question, the state court never found the evidence cross-admissible, correct?
That's right.
And the state court also never instructed the jury that it couldn't consider the evidence from one crime to prove the other. It gave a general instruction that it ought to consider the counts separately.
That's right.
Why doesn't that amount to fundamental unfairness?
Well, first of all, there is no clearly established federal law that requires that the evidence be cross-admissible for two counts to be tried together. Actually, the joinder was based on state law that permitted two crimes of the same kind to be tried together. There is a preference under state law to try murder cases together, and there is no federal established rule that prohibits the state from doing that. There is also
we do have a post-EDPA, post-EDPA case called Davis that recognizes a due process right that could give rise to a due process violation where you have joinder of charges.
Well, I agree with that. There is a general due process protection for the defendant in this case. What I'm saying, there is no specific rules that require that the evidence be cross-admissible. There is no specific rules that require that certain instructions be given.
Don't go into whether or not under the facts of the case we have a due process violation.
Under the rules of there is no clearly established federal law that requires that cross-admissibility be a factor in deciding that whether there was a due process violation. This is just a rule of this court and a rule that actually is used by the state courts also.
Let me change the facts a little bit in this case. Let's assume these two murders occurred 20 years apart, and everything else occurs exactly the same as it does in this trial. Are you contending there's no due process problem with that?
I would say no. There is no the distance in time between the two crimes doesn't make a difference, because I think one of the factors that shows that there is no due process violation is that the crimes are very different as far as time, place, victims involved. And I think it's easier for the jury to see what facts go to count one, what facts go to count two. If there is a 20-year difference between the two crimes or whether there is a year difference, both of them show that these are separate crimes. So the prosecution in this case, actually, when prosecutor argued the facts to the jury at the end of the case, if he said these are the facts in support of count one, and then finished, then he went, these are the facts in support of count two. The prosecutor never told the jury, Mr. Collins is guilty of the Rankin murder, and that evidence shows that he was also guilty of the attempted murder of Mr. Bowman. It was actually the other way around. The prosecutor argued, these are the facts that support count one, these are the facts that support count two. Both counts were motivated by a gang, let's say, the appellant's desire for respect within his gang, but those were just the same motive, but each crime was based on separate facts. And the jury was never told to find Mr. Collins guilty of one count because there was evidence that showed that he was guilty of the other one. I think that just because a specific instruction wasn't given in this case, it doesn't mean that the jury somehow on its own went and did that, because nobody asked the jury to do that in this case. And I think the fact that both crimes were supported by distinct evidence shows that there would be no reason for
it. He also was allowed to testify. He testified as to one of the cases and then didn't. He invoked his right not to testify in the other one.
Well, the defendant made a choice, a personal choice, to testify as to the attempted murder case, but not as to the murder case, and the trial court and the prosecutor allowed him to do so and didn't interfere with his right to do so. When we talk about the strength of the evidence, which is relevant to whether there was a due process violation as to the severance issue, here this is not a case where the prosecution took a weak case to, let's say, took a strong case to bolster a weak case or two weak cases to bolster each other. The murder case was based on pretrial statements of the witnesses, but that, under California law, prior inconsistent statements of witnesses are just as strong as testimony provided at trial. What happened in this case is these are all fellow gang members, and they're afraid to show up in court and testify in front of the appellant. But it doesn't, under California law, the jury, it was up to the jury to decide when were these witnesses lying, at trial or when they were taped, recorded, giving statements to the police. This is not a case where the police just testify at trial as to hearsay statements of the defendants. Of the witnesses, I mean. They actually have tape recordings of these witnesses that were played at trial. So the jurors got to listen to their incriminating statements. It wasn't just a layer of hearsay or open a layer of hearsay as characterized by appellant's counsel. We have strong evidence as to both counts. And based on the strong evidence, there was no inflammatory count in this case. When we compared the attempted murder to the murder, both were the same type of crimes. Both were senseless gang shootings in which one victim was killed and the other one seriously injured. So this is not a case where we have, like, some kind of a spillover effect or we have some kind of maneuvering.
Why was there a need to try these two counts together?
I think under state law, there is a preference for trying these kind of cases together.
Why? I mean, I don't. I mean, Judge Hurwitz mentioned, I mean, it's questionable whether or not these should have been tried together.
I would say there is a preference because, first of all, there is some judicial economy to the fact of having just one trial for two cases.
Well, if the evidence was cross-admissible, that makes good sense.
Well, if the evidence was totally cross-admissible, then we wouldn't even be discussing the issue because the fact, if there is cross-admissibility, that clearly defeats any kind of claim of due process violation because the evidence will have come in anyway. But we have to look at the overall case in a due process inquiry.
I thought the underlying theme was that there was this gang sort of theme that...
Well, there was a cross-admissibility as far as the theory of the prosecution. Both cases were motivated by the same desire by the appellant to kind of present himself as a shot caller or somebody tough within his gang. And he's disciplining people within his own gang. So this is not a case where we have like a robbery of some innocent victim and then being joined with like a murder of somebody in another gang. We have actually two shootings, gang-related shootings of people that were connected to the appellant's own gang. And I think that's very distinctive in this case. We don't have like, as I said, two very unrelated events. But needless to say, at the same time, both were supported by very distinct facts.
Did you want to say anything about the other issue?
I think quickly as to the...
Is it waived? Did she waive the due process
claim? I was going to say there are several reasons why this court should deny the due process claim as far as the Hamilton's non-testimonial statements. First of all, it wasn't raised until the reply brief and should be deemed waived. Secondly, the due process claim itself was never certified for a better review. Third, there is no...
It's just an echo back.
All right, I wasn't sure if... Yeah. My third point is there is no clearly established federal law, due process rule against the admission of this type of non-testimonial statements by an accomplice. There may be a general due process rule that may apply to whether the trial itself was fundamentally unfair or not, but there is not a specific clearly established rule against the admission of this type of non-testimonial statements. Second, what...
Isn't there a due process right, though, to have reliable testimony?
There is no United States Supreme Court case that had specifically applied a reliability rule to non-testimonial statements. There may be a general, as I said, a general due process rule as far as whether the trial was fundamentally unfair or not, but there is no specific and clearly established rule against the admission of non-testimonial statements, and there is no specific and clearly established rule that requires that a non-testimonial statement pass some kind of reliability test as in the old Roberts test. And it is our position that Roberts is dead for all purposes. Whether it's non-testimonial or testimonial, it's a dead test.
The Supreme Court said that?
And the Supreme Court has pretty much said that in a...
Because they said it directly?
Well, they said, first of all...
Roberts is overruled. Dead law, gone.
Well, they have said that Roberts doesn't have... Roberts, there is no confrontation clause inquiry at all when we're dealing with non-testimonial statements. Yeah. Roberts' test was a test for confrontation clause purposes. It was never established by the Supreme Court for any other purpose but to decide whether there was a confrontation clause violation. Once the Supreme Court said that non-testimonial statements do not raise a confrontation clause violation at all, then the Roberts test is inapplicable to that, because that was a test that was designed for the specific purpose of this, of determining whether there was a confrontation clause violation. And I cited to several circuit court cases that were more specific, applying the United States Supreme Court cases that I cited. They went ahead and said, well, those cases, what they are saying is Roberts doesn't apply to non-testimonial statements. I think the last, just, I mean, I won't get into the details of why the evidence was reliable, but this is a case where appellant actually got more than he deserved as far as appellate review, because the state court and the district court, both of them applied the Roberts test to the non-testimonial statements, and both of them, based on the specifics of the case, found that the evidence, I mean, the statements were reliable and trustworthy. So even though appellant was not entitled to the Roberts test or to any kind of inquiry under the confrontation clause, he got it anyway. And appellant cannot show that the state court decision was unreasonable as to whether Hamilton's statements were reliable and trustworthy under the facts of this case. Since we have like a fellow gang member talking to other gang members as to what he just did and incriminating himself as a shooter and explaining why he did it. This is not like, as hearsay declarant talking to the police and trying to pass the buck to somebody else. So in conclusion, appellant cannot meet his burden of showing that the state court's determination or adjudication of his claims was unreasonable or contrary to any clearly established federal law, and the judgment of the district court should be affirmed.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Well, there was a few minutes, a minute and 30 seconds for rebuttal.
115.
Thank you.
All right. Go ahead.
In terms of, as the white dissent said, and this is not, of course, not the rule, but the white dissent said that there is a due process basis for reliable testimony, reliable hearsay testimony. That was in the dissent in white, just referring to the fact that there is that particular prong for the reliability of the testimony. As far as the cross, the severability and the cross between the two cases, both cases were incredibly weak in this case. This is not a case where one was really strong and the other, they were both weak and they both bolstered each other. One issue that was not raised in the state court by anybody was the 1235 evidence that came in, the recorded statements that Mr. Fuster was talking about. That wasn't raised, unfortunately. But that is probably a confrontation issue. That may, in fact, be a confrontation issue, because those statements were not cross-examined when they were made, contrary to the statements that were given in the Green case. But that, unfortunately, was not raised at the state level. The cross-contamination in this case was there. It's just because two people of the same gang were victims doesn't mean that Mr. Collins was the one that killed or attempted to kill either one. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments, and the matter is submitted at this time.